hands-on with the Oculus Quest. Mystery and intrigue around an Atari cabinet. And Miriam Joire is here to show us a pretty awesome $250 phone. All that and more coming up on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 81, recorded Thursday, May 2nd, 2019.
This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Hover. Register a domain name and build your online brand with Hover. Visit hover.com/twit to get 10% off your first purchase of any domain extension for the entire first year.
And by Peak PTT, the leading provider of push-to-talk systems for business communications. For instant, always-on nationwide communications, visit peakptt.com and use promo code TWIT for 15% off.
Hello, welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is the show where every week we talk to people making and breaking the tech news. I'm Megan Maroney.
I'm Jason Howell. We haven't seen anyone break this particular piece of technology yet, but I'm sure it's going to happen.
Not yet. Well, luckily, I don't think it's supposed to fold. So we'll see. It's clunky, expensive, and complicated to set up. That was the complaint of other VR headsets so far. But this week, you can order Oculus Quest for delivery at the end of the month. Scott Stein from CNET has been playing with one for over a week. He even took it with him on vacation. What? Welcome back to the show, Scott.
Hey, thanks so much for my real vacation. It became a bit of a working project. I've got it right here.
Yeah. No kidding.
It looks amazing just on the top of your head like that.
Exactly. You just go through security like this. They love it.
You don't even need to wear a hat. Like if you're on vacation on the beach, like that's basically a visor. You know?
That's your sun protection.
Yep, that's your sun protection.
Yeah. So you're kind of like
I had to tell TSA.
Yeah. Right. You're kind of like a doctor, like a tech review doctor. Like you're always on call. If something comes out, vacation, beach vacation, be darned.
Activate virtual reality.
So what?
It's true.
What were your initial thoughts on the Oculus Quest?
You know, I've used a ton of this stuff, and I think there's still a question of who's going to use it and how much does it cost and how easy it is to set up. I love it for how easy it is to use and how immersive it is. I mean, people who look at different levels of VR and you say, oh, is this the best VR? Most people still have never used VR, and it feels like a PlayStation VR. It feels close enough to the stuff on PC that it's kind of stunning. And I think the controls are really what's amazing. It's using the same Oculus Touch controls, basically, except with camera tracking inside out in the headset. But the fact that it's got the buttons, the vibration, you can move around in the environment. This is the stuff that 3 years ago, I was wondering, would it exist? And if I showed my three-year-old self and 3 years ago self in 2016 what this was, I'd be shocked. Now, of course, it's self-contained, and the question of how big the app library will be depends on how much Facebook can develop it and not be too closed off, but it really does feel like a self-contained game system in VR that doesn't have that many compromises. I mean, it is a mobile processor, but at that price and for what it does, it's pretty astounding.
So you took it on vacation. We should say that, I mean, is it like the Nintendo Switch? Is it intended to be like, I'm going to bring this to the bar. I'm going to bring it on vacation.
No, I discovered its limits pretty fast. This is, you know, it is like the Nintendo Switch in that it's taking mobile and bending it and bringing something that feels like a larger scale experience on the road. But this headset is big. It's got stiff arms. You have to bring this carrying case. You've got these controllers, which are not insignificant in size. You know, this is the size of the controller, and they have these like kind of awkward rings. Yeah. So you can get a carrying case from Facebook, which I would recommend, or from Oculus for $40 that can hold it all, because otherwise you'd be worrying about scratching the lenses on this thing or how you're going to carry it delicately. And also every moment you spend in VR, needless to say, is a moment you're not spending with your family or everyone else.
It's on vacation.
You can't multitask with this. So there's no casual iPad Switch feeling of just turning on for a few minutes and chilling out. It's all in and you're moving around. So that's a really cool experience, but it's not cool if you're trying to do something else.
Yeah. So this is, definitely, in the scale of different options as far as VR is concerned, this sits below the full-blown kind of computer-driven Oculus system, but above, the Oculus Go, of course, the hand controllers obviously being a really big part of that. Those hand controllers really seem close to what you get in the full scale version of this. Is it close enough? I guess that's the question, right? For $400, you're taking some exceptions around the quality of the hardware that's driving it. And even some of the games between the full-blown system and this are the same, but how different are they? How are they accounting for the lesser processor that's in here versus the full-blown system?
I think it's one of those examples of when you see something that's been really well optimized, let's say like a tablet that's running software that really makes the most of it. The faster tracking and what they've done with the games, and particularly the way the controllers feel, these screen captures are running at a slower frame rate by far than what it feels like in the headset. So this is fine. It looks so much better when you're using it. Mm. And this is for quick shares of video, but it feels, that feel is great. And we're also playing a lot of indie games, or I am, that are lower graphics, kind of they're pixely, and that's a style. So that fits perfectly well into this because everything runs super smooth. But I think the question is for creators. People have been asking me, could I do work on this? And that's the part where I'd say, no, not now, because there are no apps. Tilt Brush is a great art app for PC. It is coming out for Quest, but I haven't used it yet. So I think for games, it's great, but you can see its limits. There are certain details and textures, and companies are going to have to learn how to port games into it. On the Switch, you have a whole indie game landscape that's been well developed where they're pulling from that. But the question is, will they run out of games to port to Quest? And will there be enough indie developers that want to dive in and do that? And then will there be another one right around the corner with a faster processor? So those are the things to kind of weigh out with it. But it's totally capable of delivering for Beat Saber, for games like that sports game, which is like Wii Sports. That feels like you're playing on a game console. That feels like you're playing on a PlayStation VR. It feels indistinguishable.
So how much space do you need? Do you need an entire room? Did it work well? I assume you did it inside in a hotel room. How much space do you need?
I did. So, you actually should not be using this outdoors. And I mentioned that in the review. And, it is actually recommended because the light will throw off the tracking, direct sunlight. And not only that, and this is totally embarrassing. You will look bad using VR. Just accept that. Mm-hmm. Hopefully not as bad as me. But also direct sunlight could cause burn-in on the display if you let it go through the lens. Oh, that's just a lens thing. So stay away from sunlight. Be a vampire. Go indoors. But the tracking, you could do it standing still. They have a sitting mode as well. For movement, they recommend 6.5 by 6.5 feet. That's a pretty large amount of space. That's not – you don't normally have 7x7 just sitting around waiting to be used, particularly without obstacles. And that's the thing is you can paint flexible boundaries. So I moved it into spaces. You see the world around you and you can paint around the floor and draw like a magic crayon, the space that then becomes your fenced in world. And that's the coolest part. So it will adapt your boundaries, but it won't adapt the game. So it will just put up a glowing blue fence to say, don't go any further.
Right.
Of course, it doesn't have navigational auto awareness to see obstacles on the fly. So if a kid comes walking in, a dog, somebody moves a chair in, or you didn't account for the chair, you could really injure yourself. So that's a problem. You really should use it in a space where you know people aren't coming in.
How do you compare the inside out tracking that's here with some of the higher end systems? Obviously the higher end systems, they're using external cameras. This is the direction of VR, right? The kind of holy grail, at least in the now, in the capabilities of technology at this stage, is high quality inside out tracking so that you don't need a PC. This is kind of the first real flavor of that on a higher end system. It's just below the major systems. Are there some quality differences between this inside out approach and the cameras that are sitting in the room that are tracking you?
I mean, so far it's worked really well. I've surprisingly found very few problems with it. And that's pretty astounding. Even when you bring your controllers, maybe it's the apps and how they use it, But when you bring your controllers back, they're just doing some processing between basically the controller, and it's not using the camera anymore. But that worked well enough. Occasionally glitches. If you bring it very close to your face or down here, the range might drop out. But there aren't really a lot of VR apps that explore that level of intimacy for controls. Usually it's about over here. So for everything that I've been using it for, it does feel great. That being said, again, the lighting is one thing that throws it off. And if you're talking about multiple people in a room and you're talking about full room awareness, it is really only scanning what's out there in front of your head. And so I'm not sure how it might impact. I mean, certainly something like Vive that's using those lighthouse trackers and covering a whole room will provide for any purpose, like a much more accurate type of tracking. But it really works. Like, basically, you think, oh, I'm using this. It's fine. And it kind of shows where computer vision and cameras are heading in the future.
Yeah.
So it's $400. Based on your week with it, what do you think of that price tag?
Yeah, it's a good question. I've told people it's $400, and a lot of people say, nope, not for me, no thank you, because they look at it like a game console in that perspective. Or, is it an impulse buy at $400? Probably not, no. But in the VR landscape, there isn't anything, I think, that's comparable, that's close to that. And if you look at like the HTC Vive Focus, that's enterprise, but they're selling that for $800. And Oculus is actually selling this for more for enterprise. So it's hard to judge, but there isn't anything that's coming in that's doing this for $400. And I think compared to, then you look at AR headsets, even smart glasses, a lot of those are $1,000. Magic Leap is $2,000 plus, totally different product. But it really puts the $400 in perspective, like the Samsung Galaxy Fold, $2,000, this is $400 doesn't seem too bad in a year where we're seeing a lot of expensive products like that.
Mm-hmm. Scott Stein is a CNET's senior editor for reviews of wearable tech. You can watch his unboxing and find his full review and more video of him outside on the beach wearing this headset, which is amazing. Just go right for that. Go to CNET.com. Thanks so much for joining us, Scott.
Thank you, Scott.
Hey, thank you very much.
It was great talking with you.
Yeah, you too. More to come. I'll still be testing it.
Awesome.
All right.
After the break, we delve into the mysterious world of Atari game cabinets and stolen ROMs. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Hover. Building your online brand has never been more important, and buying a domain name for your passion is the first and also the biggest step to building your personal brand online. And keeping that domain name separate from hosting gives you the flexibility to choose the right platform for your business. No one wants to be stuck with a solution that doesn't meet her needs. These days, you don't just need a great domain name. You need a fancy domain extension to go with it. MeganMaroney.pizza, anyone?
Heck
no,
yeah.
You can't have it because I have it. I have it.
Oh.
Hover has over 400 domain extensions to choose from. I actually don't really have it. So I don't have it yet.
I'm like, yes.
I don't have it. Yet. And if you have it, I'll buy it from you. The one that the extension that we really like lately is .me. .me is a unique extension to use for your portfolio to showcase who you are and what you do. If you've got a portfolio website ready to launch, get the .me extension, and then you are complete. Hover offers the best-in-class customer support team. They don't upsell you. Don't have to worry about that. They're not trying to sell you a car. They have a clean and simple user experience and a great interface. They have personalized email that matches your domain so that, once I get Megan to Maroney.pizza, I will send you email from MeganMaroney.pizza, and that will further support my online identity. And the Hover Connect feature also allows you to connect your domain name to many website builders with just a few simple clicks. Go to Hover. I love it. There's so many. I just enjoy looking through all of my options. So go do that. This year, find a domain name for your passion. Visit hover.com/twit and get 10% off your first purchase of any domain extension for the entire first year. That's hover.com/twit for 10% off your domain extension for a full year. And of course, we thank Hover for their support.
So once upon a time, there was a company that called themselves Atari. They were on top of the world, releasing hit after arcade hit, especially in the 80s. They were on fire. One game called AKR, I think I'm pronouncing that right, made it all the way to the prototype phase. The game fully developed and imprinted inside a small, and I'm talking small, handful of full-size arcade cabinets. Those prototypes are now gold for game collectors today. But Kyle Orland from Ars Technica wrote a piece that I just really loved. It really captured my imagination. It made me feel like a nerdy kid again instead of the nerdy adult that I am. Welcome to the show, Kyle.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you, Kyle. Thank you so much for hopping on. So there aren't many times where classic video games, the emulation community, and potentially criminal intrigue come together like this one. So let's start with the game itself. Why did Atari choose to bag this particular game? What happened to that small pool of cabinets over the years? I saw some gameplay footage. It looks like a really fun game. What's the story behind that?
Yeah, it looks pretty fun. It's a game that dates back to 1982. Akaar, I think you're pronouncing that correctly. It was developed by Dave Ralston and Mike Halley, who went on to develop a lot of other games, including Paperboy. And the game actually stands for also known as Another Ralston Holly, according to lore. So they made this game and went through the whole production process. They test marketed it in a few places. And as the story goes, people said it was too confusing. It was kind of a take on the Missile Command trackball theme, but it was rotational. And there was a part where you had to zoom in if they got too close to you. So you had to switch between, you know, different screens, and that was kind of too confusing for people. So they made two or three prototypes and then never went anywhere with it. Those prototypes were eventually saved from a literal dumpster diving. It seems when Atari got bought out by Midway, Atari Games got bought out by Midway, and then these prototypes eventually just made themselves out to, in like 2003, went out by a dumpster somewhere. And that's where people just took them in, figuring they would be worth something someday. And, you know, now here we are. They definitely are.
Yeah, absolutely. Any time, you know, a video game collector can find something that is not only a developed game that never was released, but also actually exists inside of a cabinet that can be traded, I imagine these things go for a lot of money. So let's get to the intrigue part of this story. The ROM for this game suddenly appeared online for the very first time. When you're talking about the MAME community, the multi-arcade machine emulator community, they're always looking for, you know, that small pool of games that have just never been released, even though everybody knows they exist. Well, this is one of them.
Right.
What is the theory behind how this even made it to the public in the first place if it only existed on a couple of machine cabinets?
Right. So with most games, there's, you know, dozens or hundreds of machines out there, and someone has ripped the ROM and put it into MAME. So there's now, you know, thousands of games supported by MAME, but there are a few, and they're very limited at this point, that have just never been ripped. They're not supported by the emulator. No one knows where they are or how to get them. And Akaar was one of those, because there's only two or three cabinets out there. They're very tightly held by collectors that really value their privacy. So earlier in April, the ROM of this actually did come out for MAME. It was announced by the Dumping Union, which is a group of people who are devoted to getting every arcade game in existence into MAME. And they just said it came from an anonymous donor. No one really knows how they got it. But then there was an accusation on a very big message board from a guy named Atari Scott on the message board. And I'll read a little bit from what he said. He said, "There are only three machines ever built. All are in high-end collections. One collector had a tech come and work on some of his games. The unscrupulous tech copied the ROMs without permission.
Oof.
The game was not broken and not one he was supposed to fix. The owner is reviewing a couple months of security video to see if he can catch him in the act. This is the first time that someone has actually had the balls to steal ROMs from a collector. This game hasn't been in MAME for 37 years, and the accusation coming out is that a tech who was working on a different game from this collector actually went over to the Akaar cabinet, copied out all the ROM details, and then gave it to the Dumping Union to put up, which is definitely unprecedented if true.
So you've done a lot of research. Atari Scott, some people think that this is Scott Evans, who's well known in the community, but you were not able to contact him. You reached out in a lot of different ways, and has anyone reached out to you, or has he reached out to you since this story went up on Ars Technica?
No, I've not been able to talk to Scott himself. We'll backtrack a little. Scott Evans is a well-known Atari collector in these circles. He's been collecting prototypes for a number of years. He had two Akaar cabinets at one point. Seems to have sold at least one of them. But he's a very private person. I've reached out through a number of friends and other people to try and get in touch with him. But Atari Scott is the handle he uses on a lot of other message boards. And I've heard from a few people who've confirmed that this is definitely Scott Evans talking on this message board. So the accusation coming from him, it does lend it some credibility. He's definitely deep into this world. He has been a collector himself. He definitely knows the people who own the AKR cabinet. I've also been able to talk to at least one other collector who has heard from the person making this accusation, the AKR cabinet owner, who wishes to remain private, and I've not been able to talk to either. But apparently he is telling the same story to the other AKR cabinet owners, who are obviously a very tight-knit group. So this is not just, you know, an anonymous message board troll putting this out there. This is deep in the collector community, the story that's being passed around. Now, just because this story is being told, of course, doesn't mean it's necessarily true. It could be a cover story, for instance, for one of the owners deciding, oh, hey, you know, enough is enough. The preservation is more important. It's time to put this ROM out there. But he doesn't want the other collectors getting mad at him for possibly reducing the collectible value. So he said, oh, it was this tech. He came and stole it. It wasn't my fault. You know, I let him in. And oh, no. It's hard to say which is which without anyone, you know, actually going on the record. And, you know, with this insular community, it's very hard to get them to talk to the press sometimes. They don't want people, you know, invading their privacy or trolls coming in and trying to buy the game off them. But, you know, as far as we can tell, it's a credible allegation, even if we can't 100% confirm it.
And I mean, you know, when you're a collector of something like this, I guess, like, where is the value derived? Is it the cabinet that has the original game, which I imagine will always have a lot of value? Or is it the game itself? Because if the game itself now exists on MAME, maybe that lowers the value of the cabinets, in which case, like, why would one of the three owners of this highly collectible cabinet decide to leak it? But I think, you know, what you were talking about, video game preservation, that might be the key there, right? Like, as the hardware on these cabinets age, that's one day closer to basically that hardware dying entirely. And if there is no backup of it that exists anywhere, then basically all of the effort and energy that went into what could be a historical kind of mark in the history of video games disappears with it, right?
Yeah, so it's important to lay out a few things. First of all, just because this isn't publicly dumped on MAME or wasn't publicly dumped doesn't mean it wasn't preserved.
That's true, yeah.
Scott Evans himself, back in 2009 forum post, he wrote, everything does not need to be in MAME for it to be preserved. The implication being that these collectors have backed up their own ROMs. Obviously, they know the value of what they have. So if those original chips break down, theoretically, they have their own copy. Just because they haven't shared it with the internet doesn't mean it doesn't exist. They don't have, you know, some way of making sure that it gets out there, I don't know, after their death or what. They're not talking about this, but it's not hard to believe that they've backed up themselves.
Sure.
Now, that being said, there's a big debate about whether this even does have any effect on the value of the cabinets themselves. As you said, the cabinet is, you know, an object of art in its own right. It's still one of only two or three out there that exist, and a very rare collector's item and a lot of interest to historians. The ROM that was stolen, stolen might not even be the right word. The ROM data was copied, but the cabinet is still there. When someone robs your house, you know, they take your TV, you don't have a TV anymore. They still have the cabinet, and it still has some inherent value. Now, whether the cabinet's value is based on, oh, this is the only way to play this game that was, you know, test marketed in one city and, you know, no one has any memories of, really, I'm not sure that necessarily holds water. There's not a lot of nostalgia out there for AKR among people.
Right.
That said, they have let it be played at, you know, conventions like California Extreme. The owners will occasionally bring it out so the community can at least get their hands on it. Yeah, there's a shot right there of someone playing it at California Extreme. So it wasn't, you know, unplayable necessarily. It was just very rare and hard to get. Now that it's out there, everyone can kind of play it and see this kind of curiosity of Atari history, and that's probably better for the community as a whole. As far as the cabinet owners are concerned, I can see them being, you know, pretty upset if this is a true story. Also, I don't think the collectible value is necessarily totally gone just because, oh, now I can play this game without, you know, having to spend, you know, tens of thousands of dollars on one of a few cabinets.
Right.
I don't think the people who are going to buy the cabinet are that's really their reason for buying it. They want it to own it. They don't want it to play this particular game necessarily.
Right.
So because I like mystery and intrigue, what do you think about this, this supposition I have? What if the people who owned it then put it out there in order to create more attention for this thing that mostly everyone had forgotten? So they want to, because I had never heard of it. Jason, had you ever
heard
of it?
I
mean, I'm sure you'd heard of it, but so now it's raised the interest in this game that mostly everyone had forgotten about. And just by like creating this controversy, what do you think of that?
That's an interesting theory. I hadn't actually heard that before. You know, more people have heard of this game now, and now, if a buyer wants to come along, it's something that is out there in the public consciousness. I will say that the quote-unquote official story that's out there about looking through months and months of security tapes to find out, you know, who did this and when, that seems a little far-fetched to me. You should pretty much be able to figure out, oh, the tech was here, you know, these days. Let's see if he touched the AKR cabinet. And, you know, if until and unless they actually, you know, publicize this and bring a lawsuit or something, it's going to be hard to prove that that's exactly what happened. And even if that does happen, it's unclear what law would even apply. Some sort of trespass, maybe, but definitely not the, you know, copyright infringement. The collectors don't own the copyright to this game; they just own the cabinet. So making an illegal copy could be, you know, illegal computer access or something like that. But definitely not to the level of copyright infringement.
All right. Well, finally, I want to end on this note from a very personal, selfish perspective. One of my favorite games when I was younger was Marble Madness. I played it all the time. And of course, one of the other games that falls into this category, similar to AKR, is the Marble Madness sequel that was totally developed. It was called Marble Man, and it's never found any sort of public release. What are the odds that this happens with Marble Man? Because I'm like crossing my fingers, although this never happens, so it's probably never going to happen.
Well, if you have a ski mask, I'll go help you break into the house to get that game, because that's another one that really on my list. Scott Evans, actually, who we talked about, actually owns two copies of that, I believe, or did at one point. And yeah, he's not interested in publicly releasing it. But if you go to California Extreme or something, you can try it out. I hope you like using joysticks instead of the trackball, because they changed that for some reason.
Oh, okay. Well, that does kind of dampen my enthusiasm just a little bit. But still, it's a sequel to one of my favorite games, so of course I won't.
I know.
Kyle Orland, thank you so much for joining us. Kyle writes, of course, for Ars Technica, and I highly encourage everyone to go check out this piece. It's a long read, but I love it. It checks so many boxes in my mind, and when I read it, I knew I had to get you on. Kyle, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks again, Jason.
All right, we'll talk to you soon. Up next, we have Miriam Jouard joining us in studio to forecast what we expect to see at Google I/O next week and a few other things. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Peak PTT, the leading provider of push-to-talk systems for business communications. Company cell phones are not only expensive, they can also be huge time wasters for employees. So you can boost productivity and cut down costs today with Peak PTT. Peak provides advanced IP-based push-to-talk systems for small, medium, and enterprise businesses, so you can leverage the internet, cellular data, and Wi-Fi networks to transmit your voice over the internet. It provides instant talk, location monitoring, emergency alert notifications, local, nationwide, and worldwide coverage, rugged devices that are made to withstand dirt, water, and extreme temperatures, so no, you know, delicately holding onto your cell phone that's going to crack the second it falls on the ground. No contracts, and billing is month to month, less than 1 second of connection time. So again, you're not like ringing and ringing, waiting for the other person to pick up. Beep, it goes right through. Connect with hundreds of users at once, or you can talk privately with anyone in your group. There's central tracking and communication center from any PC, so it makes it easily trackable. Of course, real-time GPS tracking for accurate and complete visibility. The K2 PTT system is ideal for small and medium-sized businesses. That's the system that has an affordable walkie-talkie style handset, PTT 84G, iOS and Android apps, and PC dispatch software for device location tracking. The Everest PTT system, which is what I happen to have right here in my hands, is capable of handling deployments of any size. This includes the PTT 584G rugged handset, and it's got, you know, it's an Android-based handset with a touchscreen and everything. It's just a really cool device to keep you connected. Five nines of network availability, lower latency rates than some of the most significant players in the industry, PC-based dispatch console to locate devices on demand and even view it on a map, and of course, push-to-talk calls last an average of 15 seconds, so it keeps you succinct and right to the point versus 50 seconds for traditional calls. Get in touch faster and operate more efficiently with Peak PTT. Visit peakptt.com and use promo code TWIT at checkout for 15% off. That's peakptt.com and use promo code TWIT for 15% off. We thank Peak PTT for their support. So like I said, joining us in studio is none other than Miriam Jouar, Tank Girl on the internet. How you doing, Miriam?
I am here. Hello. I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. It's awesome to have you on.
Thanks for having me on. It's my first time on this show.
Yeah.
Thanks,
yeah.
Megan. It's like, wow, I'm not in the middle usually.
This yeah,
very
I know.
Weird.
I know.
We're now both... I know how you feel.
Do you feel like you're being put on the spot right now? All right. We've invited you to talk about something very serious, Miriam.
I have a coffee. I'm okay.
Yeah. It's not an intervention.
I can make this work.
Okay.
This is a Google I.O. intervention.
Oh, boy.
So we thought we'd talk to you a little bit about Google I.O. Google I.O., of course, is next week. I'm looking forward to it.
You're going to be there, right?
I'm absolutely going to be there.
I'll see you there.
Roaming the halls, which aren't actually halls. It's basically like you're going to an outdoor concert for 3 days.
Laser.
It's a
hall.
Yes. it's a cool experience going to Shoreline and doing Google I.O.
It's kind of weird. Make sure you bring a sunscreen, right?
Yeah. Well, uh-huh. And they usually even give you sunscreen while you're there.
Yeah, but last year they didn't, and they didn't give us sunglasses either. The way I know this is because I always wear their sunglasses. And then, like, I ran out, and I was like, where's my I.O. sunglasses? They didn't give me one.
So. Yeah, plus, you got to be careful with that sunscreen. You don't know what's in it. It might be, like, secretly tracking your location or something.
I haven't even thought about that.
Nanobots.
You're talking about the future right now, Megan. That's frightening. Here, put on the sunscreen.
I just made that up, by the way.
No. I might just stay home next week.
Well, I hope that you're there. I hope to run into you at Google I.O. What if you had to, like, pick one thing that you're really looking forward to at Google I.O. I mean,
you know, I'm kind of a hardware person. So, I mean, I love like hardware only enable ecosystems and software and apps, right? But I love the idea that we're going to get a mid-range Pixel.
Yeah. We know this for certain at this point.
Well,
it's like 99% certain. They've said as much in their earnings call.
Yes. It's hard because, you know, even PR is being like saying different things to different people right now, which is like, come on, guys. Like, I mean, we know, we've seen the leaks. They pretty much admit that on their earnings call, right? As you said. I mean, look, it's not official, but there's a really high probability we're going to see two Pixels that are mid-range phones, priced as such, which, I mean, U.S. pricing, you have to understand, mid-range phones in the rest of the world are much cheaper than even these phones would be. Mm-hmm. But we're going to look at two Pixels that basically bring the Pixel experience to a lower price point, to more affordable price point, which I think is really exciting.
And more affordable. Right now, the rumors, although we don't have any confirmation, but the rumors are saying somewhere in the $400 range for the 3A and the $479 for the 3A XL. So firmly in that mid-range price category.
I mean, I'll be honest, at that price point, I expect the camera to be an exact copy of what we have on the Pixel 3 and 3 XL.
Yeah.
We might get lesser materials, maybe, plastic back instead of glass. Mm-hmm. We might see a headphone jack, though. That might be cool.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know. There were rumors about that.
Yep.
And then we might see a lesser processor. It doesn't look like the RAM's going to change much because 4 is pretty much the bottom that you can handle. In fact, a Pixel 3 XL, which I have here on, is pretty low, honestly. 4 gigs
is not acceptable anymore.
I think for a mid-range, it's fine.
Yeah.
And then, of course, displays are 1080p, which make a lot of sense. I mean, there are some flagships like the P30 Pro from Huawei that are 1080p, so that's not a big deal. And then some 600, 700 series Snapdragon.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking 600, 660 is the new one. Maybe the 730 they just announced,
mm-hmm.
Because maybe for the higher end one, because that's almost an 8, like basically the 710 was an 845 detuned, and the 730 is an 855 detuned. And we're talking like 90% of the performance.
Right.
Which is pretty awesome.
Absolutely.
But at 400, it's hard, right? Like, it's a lot of money still. And I would have loved it to be 300, and then I'd be happy with 600 series Snapdragon. But at 400, I'm almost expecting them to have at least the same camera and even a 700 series processor. If you look at the competition of what you can get for $300, you can get a Pocophone F1 for $300.
Mm-hmm. But who's ever heard of a Pocophone?
The bottom line is it's available with a warranty in the U.S.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's Snapdragon 845, and it's great. It's got a good camera. Yeah. So it's a tough one. You're kind of paying for the Google brand and the Pixel brand at this point, I'm not sure that's something you can pay for. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had a big rant on my podcast this week about this, about how the Pixel 3X, the 3 series, the XL and the regular 3, are a little long in the tooth now 6 months later. And that's usually the case, but I feel like it's really long in the tooth this year when you see what, you know, OnePlus is coming out with soon, and when you see what Huawei's done and Samsung's done, and even LG, even though the G8 is not spectacular, you know, it's a really good phone. And you're going to say they're all new phones, but the reality is these phones are designed to last a year. It's odd to me that Google didn't put 6 gigs of RAM on the XL, that they really didn't push the design, the premiumness of look and feel, because that's really where people are fighting in the high end. And maybe that's where we're going to get a mid-range phone, is because they don't want to fight in the high end. Mm-hmm. It's not profitable for them. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's obviously not profitable for a lot of people, as we saw from everybody's earnings.
Yes.
But I still think that, you know, in the same way as you see an Audi R8 and you do end up going buying an Audi A4, you need that halo. You need that flagship device. And that's why I'm hoping there's a Pixel 4 that – I'm actually hoping this lets them go nuts with a Pixel 4. I want to see a $1,000 Google phone that, you know, has no – nothing's held back. Triple camera on the rear. Like, this is where we're at for flagships. And I'm sick and tired of seeing, you know – Google kind of pull back, kind of like Appling the whole thing, Appling, because Apple is basically doing that. They're like, this is just an interface into our world. It's just, forget about the hardware. Leave your body behind. This is about your soul and your mind. No, I want a freaking phone that feels like a freaking phone. That's the flagship. And so I'm having a lot of struggles as a Pixel daily user with this. Like, so I'm very excited about the 3A and 3A XL, because I think if they exist at a reasonable price point and hit the sweet spot, now everybody can have a Pixel, and I can maybe have a better Pixel in the fall, like a really nice Pixel, like a $1,000 Pixel.
This would be your Pixel before the next Pixel. It's like stepping stones for you, because I feel like you have a new phone every week.
$1,000 list is not really going to be $1,000. We know that. Like, so yeah. I'm saying, like, right now, for what the Pixel, full-on Pixels that were launched 6 months ago cost, I expect a lot more than what I got. Mm-hmm. And so for them to justify continuing making flagships at $850, $900 next year, in the fall in October for the 4, we're going to have to see something that is much cheaper. And that's why I think they came out with this, or they're coming out with this.
Yeah.
You know? So do you think this might be for people switching from iOS, like people who had
iPhones? No way, not a chance in the world. I mean, look, the reality is Apple people are they're not going to move.
Well, I know people who have moved, and they either moved to Samsung or the Pixel. Right. And there's no, I mean, then, is there a mid-range Samsung phone?
Yes. Well, but the 10SE to me is right now $600.
Yeah.
And honestly, that's more that's than like the 400 mid. We're talking about. But there's no contest. This is a full-on flagship you're getting. And it's also a super small phone. Mm-hmm. It is smaller physically than the Pixel 3. And I think for the money, it's probably the best flagship you can buy right now. I'm not a Samsung person.
The 10 series is really great.
The S10e is hard to beat at this point.
Right.
And it's continuing to go down in price, because you know that's what happens. Mm-hmm. The other one's the LG G8, even though it's not the reviews where, man, I wrote a review on geekspin.co. You can read it. That's where also the phones we're talking about next are reviewed by me. And that phone is, if it drops in price a little more than it is, it went from 700 to 650 and might now be down to 600 soon. I'd say the G8 is just up there with the S10e. Why would you bother buying a Pixel other than the software updates and the camera? At that point, if they can bring the software updates and the camera for $400, then the 3A makes sense, right?
Yeah.
But don't buy a Pixel 3 right now is what I'm saying. Don't.
Does the A stand for anything? 3A? No.
Accessible?
maybe they'll make the case for that at Google.
How about a shot a shot across the bow.
Yeah.
Available?
Okay.
Wow. I wonder if teenagers might be interested. I wonder if this might be a phone.
It's too high.
See, teenagers have high phones
I mean, look, there's two worlds here. The reality is this, is if you look at U.S. Average customer, I don't even think that phone makes sense, the 3A. Mm-hmm. Because first of all, how many people are going to switch to a Pixel? Number one, unless the marketing is really strong behind it, but so far Google has never shown that.
Yeah.
Number two, people just walk in a carrier store and they're not afraid of adding $20 a month mm-hmm. to their plan to get an actual $1,000 flagship. We've seen mm-hmm. this on and on and on. This is how the U.S. works. So the teenagers, they all have flagships. Why would they go? So now if they are on price conscious and they're buying an unlocked phone full price, they're not going to spend $400. They're going to spend $200 on the phone I'm going to talk about mm-hmm. next. And that makes sense. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. $400 is still kind of like $500 buys you have OnePlus 6T. You forget the fact that the 7 is coming. Mm-hmm. 6T, $500.
Fantastic
I'd
phone.
Take that over Pixel 3A any day of the week, mm. frankly. I mean, it's better in every way, in every measurable way, maybe except the camera.
Yeah, but there are of course the Google brand devotees that want those updates.
You know, but I'm really I'm kind of reevaluating my life right now.
I understand.
I'm having an existential crisis because I've been a Nexus and Pixel user forever, and I'm really getting sick and tired. Like, I have now a phone that I can't talk about in my pocket that makes me realize that maybe I need to switch away from Pixel. And I've said that many times, but I've actually gone through with it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think I'm like Stockholm syndroming now about the Pixels. I'm like, but it's okay. 4 gigs is
fine.
And the camera is so good.
I completely understand. I completely get it. I feel the same way, right? Like, I feel like part of my reason for staying with a Pixel, but yet also I do actually enjoy my Pixel 3, is the fact that because I do what I do, I feel like I need to be really close to Google's vision of Android.
I mean, you're the only person in the entire universe using a Pixel Slate.
I very well could be, actually.
Sample size of one.
Cool.
I mean, I'm still using my Pixelbook. I think it's a way better device.
Yeah, yeah. I'm kind of dedicated to the Slate for the next year. It's the current one.
You have to.
So
it's
what I do. As far as I.O. in general, before we get to the phones that you have here.
Well,
like,
I'm going to leave you a list of things. There's Android Q, of course.
Of course.
And, I mean, we all know what to expect. I mean, it's been laid out by many people now, and because the beta's out. Yeah. Stadia, of course. Google game universe. That's very exciting. We don't know the pricing yet, so maybe some pricing.
Maybe they'll have some demo stations for everybody to kind of play around with it and see how good it is.
Fuchsia?
Or not.
The OS that's supposed to kind of like replace, but you know, the new OS, right? Yeah. That's merging Android and Chrome OS. Of course, there's going to be Chrome OS news, I'm sure. Wear OS news. Mm-hmm. Rumors of a Pixel Watch, I don't buy it. I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, if they're going to launch a device, it's going to be the Pixel. And do you expect them to launch any more devices?
Well, there have been some rumblings around the Nest Hub Max.
There's that. And there's some Coral device that's come up.
Yeah, yeah.
With quotes because we don't know what the code name. Google Home, Google Things, Google Assistant. I think these are all the things that are going to be potentially bringing us lots of news.
Yeah, and they, you know, of course, they allude to a lot of this in their their app that kind of details all of the different talks that you can go to, and a lot of that opens up after the keynote, you know, for the sessions and everything.
Absolutely.
So I'm sure we'll learn a lot more. I'm actually going to be at Google I/O next week, so I won't be on this show like for the entire show, but I'll be calling in from Google I/O like I did last year to join you, Megan, and we can talk about.
What the A stands for.
What the A, first and foremost.
Accessible.
The most important
available.
Question. What does that A stand for?
It is a weird name. I really hope that there's just a code name. I think Pixel 3 Lite and 3 Lite XL would be sweet. It would sound really great.
That would be more, that would explain a little more than 3A.
It's like when the rumors of the Apple iPhone XS Max were coming out for the naming. Yeah. Everybody was like, no. And then they did it anyway. I mean, it's a terrible name.
It is.
So obviously, you know, you play with a lot of phones, you're known, you do really great detailed analysis of hardware, and you have a couple of phones here that you've mentioned even a couple of times in this chat, that you think that, you know, might be a good alternative for the 3A, the Moto G7 and G7.
Well, I think they're
cheap.
They're definitely at a cheaper price point. Like, you won't be able to apple and oranges compare them. Like, I think that the Pixel 3A is going to be a better phone. But if you're looking for a phone in the $200 to $300 range,
this is a little bit low.
Moto has always had the G series, which has always been kind of like, I don't know. a good reference point, at least for the North American market, because, you know, with the new Chinese brands like Redmi and Realme and all the other ones out there, the sub-brands of the big players, there's some incredibly cheap phones for $200 to $300, like the Pocophone F1, you got the Honor 8X, but these phones are not available in the U.S., right?
So, and if they are, you may not even know that they do exist.
Yeah,
you know,
so I write reviews for geekspin.co, which is a tech blog, and sometimes I write reviews for them, and they asked me to review this phone now. Let me just clean it a little bit. I don't know if you can see, it's full of fingerprints. There you go. So as you can see, it looks pretty shiny and blue.
Yeah, it's got a nice blue shimmer to it.
And then it's got a little notch action up here, as you can see. It's a pretty large display, 6.2 inches. So this phone is physically the size of like a Pixel 3 XL, roughly. So it's a pretty big phone. But here's the kicker about this phone. The G series has always had three variants, like the middle of the range G, and then there's a lower, cheaper G called the Play, G7 yeah. Play, then there's a G7 Plus, which is kind of a higher end. So, and they're all between $200, a bit less than $200, and a bit more than $300. And then this year they added this new one called the G7 Power, and it slots right below the 7 above the Play, and it's $250, and it has a 5,000 milliamp hour battery.
Wow.
And to give you perspective, 720p display, so not the sharpest display, but if you look at this, it's got a Snapdragon 632, so it's pretty fast. Mm-hmm. It's got 3 gigs of RAM, 32 gigs of storage, and a 720p display, and this, it's not too thick for a, 5,000 milliamp hour phone. It's a little thick, but it's tapered nicely.
And not a couple of years ago, that would not be just a little thick. That would be thin.
Single 12-megapixel camera that's relatively decent, and an 8-megapixel front camera that's relatively decent. USB Type-C and a headphone jack. You can't go wrong. It's nice.
Yeah.
Stock Android, as you can see. Like, you can't go wrong here. You get all the usual accoutrements. Mm-hmm. And they get updates pretty often, which is really nice because the Moto takes care of updates. But here's the kicker. 14-hour screen on time.
That's ridiculous.
3-day battery life.
That's ridiculous.
So that's
And does that test out? Does it pan out for you?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is... I got 12 and a half the first time, then 14 the second time. And reading other reviews, it's pretty much everybody's 12 to 14. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. I'm not
All right.
an exception.
Yeah. Yep.
So what I'm saying about this phone is... great for the money. It's dropping down price. You can already get it for $220, I think. So at that price point, if you're looking for a $200-plus phone that is, sanctioned in the U.S., has a warranty, also works with Sprint and Verizon. It's unlocked, but it supports all the bands. You can get this phone for a little over $200, and honestly, you will not be disappointed. And on top of that, you get this killer battery life. Mm-hmm. Now, if you want to spend a little more, you can get the regular G7, which is this one here.
Which has the teardrop notch.
Which has the teardrop notch and has a 1080p display instead of 720.
Okay.
And it's thinner, a little bit thinner, not by much, but...
pulling it to the side, you're blocking.
There you go. And 3,000 milliamp hour battery, so you're no longer having that, and plus a 1080p display. But it's the same processor. You get a bit more RAM, 4 gigs, 64 gigs of storage.
Yep.
Still have a headphone jack and USB Type-C on the bottom here. I don't know if you can see it. Mm-hmm. There we go. And so dual camera, of course. So you really are stepping it up a notch because you're getting a better camera. Better display, but you're losing that battery life. And that's $50 more list, but on street prices, $250 to $70 or so. So I'm just saying, like, the Moto G still rules the roost in that sense. The G7 Power is an all-plastic phone, even though this back panel looks like glass. It's like,
man, I would not have guessed that.
It's an acrylic panel.
From 2 feet away from you, it looks
this,
like glass.
But the G7 is glass. So this is real glass. This is plastic. What's interesting is last year the G series had a metal frame, and this year it's gone back to a plastic frame. So you can tell that Moto is adjusting, constantly. Like, okay, let's see how we can get that price point. So they went for a better chip, which definitely cost them more money because last year it was $450, but now you've got, to deal with a plastic frame.
But even though this is plastic, I feel like we've come a long way from plastic, design
this is much
of
nicer.
Old. Like, this actually feels
okay, right?
Yeah, it feels
and the
okay.
Color's
it feels
really great.
Pretty premium considering that it is plastic and it looks great.
And so the other thing I wanted to point out is there is one, every phone is great in some ways and has issues in other ways. So the battery life, of course, on this phone is fantastic. What's a little unfortunate is no NFC. And I'm going to say at $200, but Google Pay is the thing. People like it. People use it. I love it.
God, I never use it.
You do? Really?
I never use it.
I mean, I use it all the time. And I think that for some people, that's going to be a really unfortunate. Like, there are phones at that price point that have it. And yeah. So I don't understand how they want it. I know they want to save money. 20 cents maybe turns it into a dollar at retail, right? But a dollar, come on. Mm-hmm. Like, a dollar, you're going to lose that in street pricing within a week, right? Like, so that's, I dock them on this every year that I review the G series. And yet they're still not adding it. And it's like, I don't understand why Moto's not doing this. Maybe because they're owned by Lenovo and the people at the top are like, we're in China. We don't get this tap to pay stuff. We use barcodes and WeChat Pay and all that. So I don't know what it is. I really want them to fix that. If they fix that, there's no, like, I could not recommend these 100%. Like, this is like 90% right now, but
still pretty good. And good background, good history, you know, as far as the G series is concerned. Yeah,
how many unlocked phones can you buy in the $200 price point that work on Verizon and Sprint? Mm-hmm. That you don't need to do anything. You just put your SIM in. I think for Sprint, you might have to call them because they still have that CDMA activation. But my point is, these are
Megan knows all about that.
These are not just Verizon LTE only phones. They are full on CDMA. They will work on 2G and 3G out in the boonies if you put a Verizon SIM in them. And there you go.
Why aren't they more popular?
I think one of the problems with this is, again, people walk into a carrier store and just buy whatever's on the shelf. This is not on the shelf at the carrier store. I think it might be, but nobody's looking at it. It's also a pretty big phone. You know, for people who are looking for like something the size of like a Galaxy S10e or G8, like 5.8, 6.1 screens, but that are no bezel. This is 6.2 inch with still a lot of bezel, especially that Motorola logo at the bottom. And as such, I feel like they're not super sexy phones and they're not super well known. People don't know they exist. I think the tech world knows they exist. Every year we sing the praises of the G series.
Yeah, it's true.
Do people actually buy them? Probably they do. I do see them out there in the wild, but not even as much as I see pixels in the wild. So,
yeah, which, you know, as we know from the earnings, there's not a whole lot of pixels out there.
Yeah.
Finally, I wanted to ask you about this because I just thought this was kind of interesting. Google yesterday announced a new feature that's they're going to allow users to set up an auto-delete schedule for some of the data that Google is collecting from them, namely location and app data. Who knows? Maybe someday they open it up, or I'm not really quite sure. What do you think? What's your take on Google's approach to privacy and letting people have more control?
More choices, more control, the better. Do they actually do it, though?
Yeah, right.
I mean, look, I trust Google more than I do Facebook, but we've known that these companies are not always doing what they say they do. And even Google has been caught a few times now, especially on location history. It's a tough one. I personally feel that all the benefits I get from, you know, giving my data to Google because I'm so immersed in the Google ecosystem like you are, I don't mind that they have my location data. I feel that, you know, maybe if they actually really delete it on their end, being able to delete it to kind of like, first of all, to reduce crud and, lower the cache data on your devices, because we have a whole bunch of devices.
Yep.
But also to, you know, kind of have you can go back so far and that's it. And that might help a little bit with privacy. You can still get all that data and the benefit from giving them the data. Mm. But, you know, it doesn't remember that you went to, you know, the Petaluma market 3 months ago because the 3 months have expired or whatever you set the schedule to delete. And that might be a bummer because maybe it doesn't remember you like the Petaluma market because you gave it a 5-star. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's the thing for me. It's
might
like
also
there are
not matter.
There are a lot of locations that I just kind of like not review, but I kind of want to prioritize because I do use them a lot.
Yeah.
And I like that Google knows that I go there a lot and that they, you know, prioritize them in my search. Like they can predict what I'm about to type in almost as
a
search.
It's kind of weird sometimes.
Good, but sometimes, you know, when you're looking for that other thing that is not normally something you look for, it makes it harder to find. And so, and you know, that's kind of the echo chamber effect.
Sure.
And it's a tough look. I don't have the solution to this privacy security issues that everybody's struggling with right now, but I do feel that these big companies need to be more mindful and, you know, more transparent. And, you know, Apple's has shown the way. At the same time, you're not getting the same benefits from a Siri that you get from a Google Assistant, you know, because they just don't have that much data about you. So I'm torn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, cool stuff. Miriam, we're going to have a little kicker thing here, and I'm curious to know everybody's thoughts on this. But Miriam, mobiletechpodcast.com.
And then geekspin.co if you want to read the reviews I just mentioned of the G8 and the LG G8 and Moto G7. This is really confusing.
Yeah.
G7 Power. Mobiletechpodcast.com. It's a weekly podcast. It's about an hour in length. If you're looking for another show to listen to, that's a lot of Android, a lot of phones, a lot of mobile tech with you've been on the show with guests. I need to have you on the show, Megan, if you don't mind.
I don't mind.
You know, great. It's a place to go. There's also a YouTube channel that goes with that, and my Twitter and Instagram handles that kind of go along. If you want to kind of follow what's going on, at TNKGRL, it's, I think, on the bottom one third for the Twitter. It's also my Instagram, at TankGirl without the vowels.
There you go. Right on. All right. So, do you guys remember the old video game Desert Bus?
Uh-huh.
You know, Penn and Teller and have done, I think they were part of creation of it. Anyways, a friend of mine and a new Screensavers guest, you may remember him, Alan Cecil. He's the creator of TazBot. He's been on Screensavers a couple of times in the past, is doing something called the Desert Tesla Charity Drive this weekend. It sounds terrifying, but it's for a good cause on Saturday, this Saturday, which is May 4th. Alan is going to hit the road with a friend of his, starting here in Petaluma. They're going to drive to Salt Lake City in his Tesla Model X, which in itself is pretty unremarkable, but he's connected his Tesla to be crowd controllable via Twitch. And first of all, nothing critical like brakes or steering or anything like that. But what will be controllable, the temperature controls, volume of music, music selection, setting the maximum speed, which can only be controllable while he's stopped. And he kept it like within a swing of 4 miles per hour of either direction of the target mile per hour, making the car dance when it hits the next stop, honking the horn again only while stopped. There's even a way to donate to a pool that will result in making the car make fart noises when the turn signal is activated. Anyways, different controls cost varying amounts. All the money generated is going to benefit the National Alliance on Mental Illness. It's pretty interesting. It just might work. You can visit taz.bot. That's TAS.BOT to find out more. Is this a good idea? What do you think, Megan?
I think it's a great idea. I am definitely going to honk that horn as much as possible.
Honk that horn. You honking that horn?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I have a Tesla, and I'm like freaked out. How did they manage to make that happen? Is it like they're hiding into it somehow?
Yeah. They've hacked into kind of the comfort controls.
What's it called? The body control module or whatever. Yeah.
So it should be very interesting. Anyways, I thought it was a really cool thing that's happening this Saturday. If you want a laugh, and who knows what else is going to happen? It's going to be all day. So check it out. Taz.bot. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday at 11 a.m. Pacific at twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show by emailing us at tnw@twit.tv.
And you can subscribe to our show at twit.tv/TNW and follow us on all the social medias. You know where we are. Twitter, Instagram. I am at Megan Maroney on the Twitter.
And I'm at Jason Howell. Miriam, of course, at Tank Girl, no vowels.
That's right.
Thanks to everyone who helps us out each and every week. Thanks to Alex for TDing. Thanks to Burke for scrolling words. John was dialing up our Skype guests and getting Miriam seated on the set. And thanks to you for watching. We'll see y'all next week on Tech News Weekly. Now we both high-five Miriam. There we go.